From the frigid foothills of the Rocky Mountains, this is Go West Young Podcast, the show all about the outdoors and America's public lands. My name is Aaron Weiss, coming to you from the Center for Western Priorities in Denver, Colorado. I'm joined this week by our executive director, Jennifer Rocola.
Hello.
And our guest just flew in from D.C., fresh off a four-year stint as Sally Jewell's number two at the Interior Department, Mike Connor. We will be talking to him in just a couple minutes about President Obama's conservation legacy, what's still to be done, and we will get his read on the first week of the Trump administration. So we usually start the show with a little news update, keeping you up to speed on what's going on in our parks and public lands. But boy, it feels like the news this week is moving faster than we can keep up. Since Donald Trump took the oath of office last Friday, we have learned that alternative facts are now a thing, and that the National Park Service is not going to go quietly into the new administration. First, the Park Service retweeted pictures showing how much smaller the crowd was at President Trump's inauguration compared to President Obama's. That led to a brief order to stop all tweets from all national park units in the entire country. That order got lifted, but was replaced with an order to not tweet anything unrelated to park business. A former employee at Badlands National Park apparently had kept a hold of the park's Twitter password and spent several hours on Tuesday then tweeting out climate change facts. Those got deleted. We have since seen climate change tweets from Golden Gate Park as well, along with some masterful subtext tweeting from Death Valley National Park, which was tweeting out stories of Japanese Americans who were kept in internment camps there during World War II. Those tweets just happened to show up as President Trump was announcing his crackdown on immigration. Meanwhile, the Department of Agriculture walked back an order that seemed to prevent researchers from publishing scientific papers. They later clarified they were only cracking down on public communications like press releases and tweets, so those economists at USDA can still publish. They just won't get any help telling the world about it for the time being. The EPA, on the other hand, is saying it will review scientific papers on a case-by-case basis, the implication there being the Trump administration could decide to squelch research into climate change if they don't like the results. Journalists are, of course, chomping at the bit right now. The Associated Press and ProPublica, among others, are reminding public service they can securely leak documents without giving themselves up. And hey, that's only the first 6 days! All right, I'm sure we will be hearing more about Donald Trump's war on science in the coming weeks. Our guest this week just departed as Deputy Secretary of the Interior, working for Secretary Sally Jewell and President Obama. Before that, he was the Commissioner of the Bureau of Reclamation. He's been the counsel for the Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee. During the Clinton administration, he was the director of the Indian Water Rights Office. And before that, he was an engineer with General Electric. Mike Connor, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate the opportunity.
President Obama just left office with a conservation legacy that will be hard for any future president to top. 33 new national monuments from the coast of Maine to the waters off Hawaii, several large monuments here in the West. Give us a sense of the scale here of President Obama's conservation legacy.
The scale is pretty significant from the president's conservation legacy perspective. It was certainly, you mentioned national monuments and the breadth of protecting these treasured lands, but it was much larger than that, and it really permeated through the entire government. And so from that standpoint, there was the protection of lands that deserve protection. There was the very significant approach to using peer-based science to assess the impacts of climate change on our landscapes and to put in place strategies to deal with the impact on land and waters, and ultimately the impact that they have not just on fish and wildlife, the landscape itself, but on communities. And so from that standpoint, there was a lot of activity in that area. The president redefined our relationship from as a federal government with Native Americans. So that's really the tip of the iceberg, but it was very significant in the level of activity in the conservation space.
Mike, thanks for being here today. As Deputy Secretary, What was your role in designating or creating these new monuments?
My role was, I was certainly part of the Secretary Jewell's senior leadership that discussed a lot of the strategies that needed to be in place, the work that needed to be done to evaluate these landscapes that were proposed for national monuments, to ensure that we were going through a transparent public process to take input on these proposals. 33 national monument designations, I can guarantee you there were a lot more proposals that came our way. So the idea was to kind of focus on those landscapes that needed protection, that best fit the definitions under the Antiquities Act. And so I'm very proud to say being part of that effort, part of the strategy development, and part of the implementation, myself participating in a number of public meetings associated with different monument proposals, was the role I played.
So for us here in the West, two of the most important monument designations came in the president's final few weeks, Bears Ears in Utah, Gold Butte in Nevada. But these weren't thrown together at the last minute. There was a long process that led up to this.
Oh, an incredibly long process associated with both of those designations, particularly with respect to Bears Ears. You know, there's been discussion about protecting those lands going back to the 1930s and 40s. And that was brought out as part of the discussion on the monument proposal. There had also been a very significant legislative initiative led by the Utah delegation of trying to put in place certain protections for some of those lands while facilitating development in other areas within Utah. Ultimately, that legislative effort was not successful, but there still was a need from the president's perspective and the administration's perspective and a lot of the Native American tribes and their leadership of the need to protect the antiquities within those areas and those landscapes. And that was the basis for moving forward after much dialogue. And the secretary herself spent a good number of time with county commissioners, public meetings, tribal leaders in discussing that proposal.
So from our perspective, it seemed like there was a long process. But when you talk to or you hear from Utah politicians, they talk about this being a midnight monument and that they were surprised that the president designated Bears Ears. But to hear you talk about it, that seems like there was a long process and that they were involved in the process.
I would say yes. There was a long process and there was involvement of the interested congressional delegation in that process. But there is opposition, obviously, at the political level in Utah. And so I think that drives a lot of the perspective on the president's designation and the use in Antiquities Act. And it goes beyond Bears Ear. There's obviously been other landscapes that have been protected in Utah that political leadership in Utah have not been supportive of. Having said that, there is obviously an economy that grows around those monuments. There is visitation. There is a lot of good activity that comes up around national monuments, as well as the important need to protect landscapes that are of scientific and cultural value.
Give us a peek into President Obama's mindset as he's considering what areas to protect, which monuments to designate. What kinds of questions does he ask? What does he want to know in order to make those kinds of decisions?
I was fortunate enough to have some interactions with President Obama as part of the cabinet engagement process, where we would come in, the secretary would come in, and we would talk about priorities and strategies and meeting those priorities. And so I think I didn't have any specific discussions with the president himself about specific monument proposals. But there was a very engaged process of talking through how these landscapes that were proposed for protection fit the Antiquities Act. That was always the foundation. You know, the Antiquities Act has certain requirements associated with it that need to be met in order for it to be eligible for the president to make that designation. So at the Interior Department, when those lands involved lands that we were responsible for, and there were also Forest Service lands and other lands that were acquired and put into national monument status. We provided that information. That was the type of exchange that we had with the president's staff regarding these proposals. So it was very engaged in a lot of dialogue and information, facts associated with the landscape that were provided.
I want to change gears a little bit and talk about your history, what you brought to the Interior Department. You're from New Mexico originally. You went to law school in Colorado. What do folks in D.C. understand and misunderstand about life and priorities here in the West?
Well, I think a lot of people in D.C., and I would put myself in this category. I have now spent the better part of two decades in Washington, D.C., but I still consider myself a Westerner. It's where I grew up. It's formed a lot of my thoughts about conservation, about use of the land. You can't separate yourself from that. So first of all, I would say it is good to have a diverse perspective about the programs that, for instance, the Department of Interior carries out. But just because I've spent a good part of my time in Washington, D.C. doesn't mean I'm a inside the beltway insider. I would still consider myself a Westerner.
Not part of the swamp.
Not part of the swamp. And maybe that's a rationalization, but I'm going to go with that rationalization. But I do think, what sometimes I see there's not an understanding of is that there is a strong conservation ethic throughout the different communities that reside in the West. It's not just the municipalities and the cities and the people that are there. There's a desire for those protections of those landscapes by people who work the land. But they do want to be involved in the dialogue about how to do it, and they should be involved because a lot of them have incredibly insightful ideas that need to be carried out. And so I think sometimes, being a Westerner, bringing that to the table, I was happy to do that. I think there is a lot of understanding, but I think some folks who haven't spent a lot of time, particularly in the rural areas, tend to lose sight of that fact. And that's one of the values of having a diverse set of folks from different backgrounds as part of the leadership of the Department of the Interior, in the White House, Department of Agriculture, wherever it is, I think is valuable.
So, Mike, you're the first person of Native American descent to serve as Deputy Secretary. How did your past work on tribal issues affect how you approach the job?
Well, it made me comfortable in stepping into the job of feeling like I understood from a legal background, Native American law, and understanding how to implement the president's priorities and Secretary Salazar's and Secretary Jewell's priorities. I mean, it was just a great opportunity for somebody of Native American background to come in and see from the very top the high priority that was put on redefining and building back trust in that trust relationship between the federal government and Native American communities, and the willingness to invest resources in those communities, and the willingness to be guided by the principles of self-determination and self-governance and respect for tribal sovereignty. So for me, I certainly tried to bring that perspective during my tenure as Commissioner of the Bureau of Reclamation. And we had a very active Indian water rights settlement program, building new infrastructure, trying to resolve tribal water rights issues, and working on planning activity with tribes. Coming into the Deputy Secretary's job and having a direct responsibility for Native American issues, budget development, running the land buyback program, which was restoring land into trust to tribal communities, and helping our very capable leadership in Indian Affairs carrying out their priorities was one of the most rewarding aspects of the job for me.
I actually want to back up there. You mentioned, so you were the director of the Bureau of Reclamation before you became Deputy Secretary?
Correct.
So that's a department that is part of Interior, not a bureau that gets a whole lot of attention relative to the Park Service, even BLM. What does the Bureau of Reclamation do for folks who aren't familiar?
The Bureau of Reclamation, and the name comes from the basic idea of reclaiming the land in the arid West. So the Bureau of Reclamation operates different from other bureaus in the department, only in the 17 Western states, the most arid states of this country. And so the idea was initially to develop water storage, water delivery projects to reclaim irrigable land, to tame rivers in the West, and to provide the foundation for agriculture as a way to settle the West. That was its initial purpose. Having done that, and when you build dams and water storage projects, then the idea, obviously, you can generate power, and hydropower development soon came as an opportunity to provide power to deliver water, but also as a way to pay for some of these projects, the revenue from hydropower generation. So that's the history of the Bureau of Reclamation, but I'm very proud of the fact that it evolved as a bureau to address some of its deficiencies in the past, which is in taming the West, you change the ecology of incredible river environments. And I would say river restoration is a fundamental part of Bureau of Reclamation's mission now. As I mentioned before, serving Native American communities, many who were impacted by that water development and ignored in initially the water development activity in the earliest 20th century. You know, they suffered from that, and now it's an opportunity to try and build back some of the economic value to tribal communities by serving those communities. So reclamation has evolved. I think the constituencies recognize the value in that broader mission, but it's a process that needs to continue and needs to be invested in moving forward.
So Mike, some of the biggest challenges at the Department of Interior is balancing multiple uses of our public lands, whether it's energy development, hunting, recreation, conservation. And this is a big question that we could easily spend an entire podcast answering, but how do you find that balance?
A couple of different ways that I think were key to striking the right balance in how we manage and use our public lands. One was using a science-based approach to better understand those landscapes, their importance as to the ecosystem, to the environment necessary to maintain fish and wildlife, to understand the antiquities involved. And that those lands, from a scientific and a technical standpoint, obviously had to be looked at more closely. Are these right places to develop, or should they be in protected status? So this idea of landscape level conservation or managing of those resources, I think, really took a hold in this the Obama administration, using science to identify areas that need to be considered for protection as opposed to development, and using information to identify those landscapes that were best suited for development activity, not just for conventional energy development, but also, you know, I'm very proud of our record, once again, driven by the president himself and by both secretaries that I served, transforming of our energy economy, particularly on the public lands, and permitting over 60 projects on our public lands, wind, solar, geothermal, developing an offshore wind program. So using science to and information to better understand how to manage on a landscape level. And then, of course, in addition to that, conversation, input from communities. What do communities want? What are they interested in? That's always going to be a part of what's needed to be done to strike a right balance. And in some cases, you know, I think communities rallied around the idea of protecting certain areas if they could focus development in other areas. This idea of master leasing plans that the BLM was carrying out is part of that landscape conservation, landscape development activity. So it's a combination of information, analysis, understanding the role of lands and watersheds to the ecology system, but also understanding the need for some level of development activity, whether it's conventional or new renewable energy development, and engaging with the public.
So Congressman Ryan Zinke, who it looks like will be the next Secretary of the Interior, talked a lot about all of the things you just talked about during his confirmation hearing and the need for balance, and he made a commitment to science, probably above and beyond certainly what any other cabinet nominee said during their confirmation hearings. If you could give one piece of advice to Congressman Zinke as he takes the job at Interior, what would it be?
I think it would be just along the lines of what I talked about in trying to strike that right balance of understanding the science, the information about those landscapes, about those watersheds, engaging with the communities of interest, which is very important from the secretary's perspective. And I think Congressman Zinke mentioned this during his hearings. I didn't get to watch all of it, but I watched good parts of it. And the need to be out there talking to folks. You need to rely on people on the ground. But I think for the secretary to get that good understanding, make the good decisions, secretary's got to be actively involved in those dialogues also. I think understanding the legal framework in which we operate, the laws that are in place, whether it's fundamentally NEPA, the National Environmental Policy Act, the Endangered Species Act, a number of our foundational statutory environmental laws that dictate how you process different proposals, whether it be for protection or development. I think it's very important for the secretary to get that understanding of what's required under those laws and where there's space from a policy perspective to make decisions and try and influence how things are carried out.
I think that also gets to the role of career staff of civil service and a lot of what we saw here in this first week of the Trump administration, this lockdown of communications at USDA and EPA, to an extent the Park Service with Twitter. But now you've got the EPA landing team, as we mentioned at the top of the show, saying they'll even review scientific research before they let it go out the door. To what extent is this normal or abnormal, what we're seeing from the first days of the transition?
I'm not sure, to be honest. I didn't walk in the door on January 20th or 21st in 2009. I came in May 2009. But I do understand that every administration, it takes a little bit of time to come in, to establish, to wanting to, have everybody be on the same message. So there's a part of it that I understand. There are parts that, quite frankly, if there's not transparency, if there's not a free exchange of information, particularly scientific information, that quite frankly did flow freely in the Obama administration, if that doesn't continue, then that's going to be an area of concern. So I'm still looking at this, trying to differentiate what is the growing pains of a new administration coming in, particularly when there's not... there's only been a couple of the cabinet-level appointees that have been confirmed so far versus what may be a change in policy and approach about the availability of information and the ability for the career federal employees to continue doing their jobs to carry out their statutory mandates, because that's very important to a well-functioning government, quite frankly.
So during your time at Interior, attendance at national parks rose steadily. With the centennial year last year, we saw record attendance in places like Grand Canyon and Zion. Are we at risk of loving our parks to death? And what can we do about it?
There is, it's the good news and the bad news. The good news being in the centennial celebration of 2016, there was a lot of focus on the parks, that highlight, that the national celebration, which a lot of folks joined in, did elevate the status of parks in people's minds, and it was translated into record visitation at a number of parks, and that's a very good thing. But it does create growing pains. We have, deferred maintenance and infrastructure needs within our parks. We need to be cognizant of ways to give people access, but yet protect the resource. I know firsthand that Director Jarvis was there during the Obama administration, was very cognizant of that point, and there was an engaged discussion at all parks, and the leadership and the superintendents at all parks were expected to continue to develop those plans that would best provide access yet protect those resources. So it's going to take investments. That's fundamental. It's certainly there were in the last two budget cycles, 2016, 2017, there were very creative ideas that I thought we put together in our budget to address that deferred maintenance and the infrastructure investments that are needed in our national parks. That wasn't acted on by the Congress, unfortunately. There were some additional resources provided, certainly, and that was helpful, but it really took, it was going to take a more aggressive approach to address some of the needs that are out there so that we can have that visitation, but yet protect the resource. So once again, I was encouraged that Congressman Zinke in his confirmation hearing talked about that deferred maintenance and talked about the need to invest in parks. And so if we're going to enjoy our parks and not love them to death, it's going to take some additional resources. And certainly from a philanthropic standpoint, the National Park Foundation, the Friends groups, they're all stepping up, but they need to have a good partner in the federal government.
So if you had to pick one memorable moment at the Department of Interior, what would it be?
Wow. One memorable moment. I think I had a lot of memorable moments. I would say one that jumps out immediately for me was being able to participate in, I think it was September 2012, in the ceremony that was in place up on the Elwha River on the Olympic Peninsula outside Olympic National Park or inside Olympic National Park for the removal of the two dams on the Elwha River. And I think for me, it was one of the most memorable experiences given the fact that it had been such a long time coming and the Lower Elwha Klallam tribe was there in the seeing the emotion from the tribe's perspective in the removal of these dams and the future opportunities that they believe would come from restored salmon runs in that area and was very encouraging seeing the coming together, the Bureau of Reclamation, National Park Service, NOAA Fisheries, a lot of agencies who had long worked on this and seeing their collaboration in studying and ultimately removing those dams was also very encouraging. I was the commissioner of the Bureau of Reclamation at the time, so I had to make it clear this was not part of a large-scale dam removal set of initiatives. But in that case, it made sense because the costs of those dams were significant enough that, it made sense on all levels to remove them and restore the benefits of that ecosystem. So from a tribal perspective, from a, interagency cooperation, from the partnership with the state, and just seeing on people's faces, something that had been enacted in 1992, the authorization to remove that and to take that hope, planning effort, ultimately to the activity itself of dam removal was just very rewarding. And then I did go back about 5 months ago and seeing the restoration activity, understanding how it had played out even better in some cases with respect to restoration of some areas for crabs and clams in the mouth of the river there and how it immediately had an impact on the health of that of crabs in that area and how that the tribe had benefited from that and hearing stories about people who had opposed dam removal and them being now supportive given the fact they saw what happened, that it wasn't a wasteland, that it the environment was quickly healing itself. The whole thing was just very encouraging. So if that gives you an indication you probably only want to ask me about one, because obviously I could go on for the next 2 hours about other great moments
but
at the Interior
Department.
But that's
been, what, just 5 or 6 years that quickly, that much transformation taking place in that ecosystem?
Yes, yeah. Exactly. So between the 4 and 5 year period, it's remarkable what happens and how the environment tends to heal itself. And it's good to understand some of the projections about how, what the river would do when freed up played out. Some of it didn't play out, and there's still some activity going on to address some of the issues that arise. But you're starting to see some of the larger, stronger fish get over some of the impediments and get up above where the dams are. And then there are plans in place to remove some of those impediments, but will allow some of the smaller salmonids that can't get over some of the barriers also to have access to some of the new habitat. So it's just very encouraging from all perspectives. And once again, I think it also revealed that you can bring a broad set of different constituencies with good information, good planning, and make those changes have broad support for that kind of activity.
It's good for the salmon. No one wants to eat lazy salmon. It's the ones that have to work on it that are better salmon to fish.
Exactly.
You can never get everything done. What was left on your to-do list at the end?
Well, one of the things that was left on the to-do list had to do with the Colorado River. And Secretary Jewell issued a secretarial order on January 18th on some of the activity that we had ongoing in the Colorado River. We had a lot of success in addressing some of the critical drought issues in the basin, not only building partnerships with the 7 basin states, on different agreements, but also building a partnership with Mexico and signed a historic agreement, both in 2010 and 2012, to partner up in conservation actions in Mexico that would benefit both countries, to do some environmental restoration in the Colorado River Delta, as well as to set in place operating rules that both countries could live by with respect to dealing with potential shortages as well as surpluses. It was a true partnership. That agreement expires at the end of this year, 2017. And so we had in place some very, in-depth negotiations over the last year, which ultimately there's a draft agreement in place, but it didn't get signed by both countries. And so that was a little bit of unfinished business that we hope does lead to completion. And that was really what the secretarial order was about. It was simply to try to ensure that the process continued, that the work continued, and that there would be a way to ensure that the new secretary is informed on the status of things if those agreements don't get finalized. So that's one example. Similar in the Bay Delta issues, Sacramento, San Joaquin River Delta in California, a lot of issues with respect to ongoing operations of federal and state water projects. The drought was devastating over the last 4 to 5 years, although it does seem to be taking a break, at least this year. That creates its own problems with flooding and everything else. But if there can be some restoration of those reservoirs and water supply there, that'll be very beneficial to both the federal and the state administrations and allow to do some more long-term planning. So we had a lot of unfinished business there that will hopefully continue on and get done. But that's the reality of government. There were a lot of things that got done that we brought to finality with respect to decisions, permits, programs that get stood up. Science that's still in place and will continue to yield information that can be used to better manage these landscapes. But there is unfinished business in planning efforts. And there's unfinished business with respect to Capitol Hill. There's still a need to reform how we fund our wildland fire suppression programs. If we're going to get ahead ultimately and deal with the threat that climate change is having, increasing the risk of wildland fire and being able to treat our lands to help reduce that risk, we've got to reform how we fund our fire programs.
All right, we are almost out of time, so I want to wrap up with a lightning round. We are going to ask you to play favorites. You only get to pick one here. So, favorite national park?
This is a killer question, but I would have to say Grand Teton National Park, given the number of times that I visit that park and my family did over the last 8 years.
Favorite national monument?
Favorite national basin and range in Nevada, where I spent a wonderful night in the wilderness.
Favorite either park or monument or public land at your home in Nevada? Or in New Mexico, excuse me.
Well, my heritage is Taos Pueblo, so the Rio Grande del Norte.
Yes. Favorite road trip?
That hurts because I'm from Las Cruces, which is Oregon Peaks.
Yes. Favorite road trip?
Oh, favorite road trip. One that we took this past year. So for the last 8 years, my family visited national parks with me. That's for our vacations. We went from Yosemite to Colorado and visited a whole bunch of places this past year. That was wonderful.
Favorite secret campground you don't want the rest of the world to know about except for the listeners of this podcast?
Can't be disclosed.
Would you rather ride a mountain bike or ride a horse?
Wow. Both have hurt me in the past. I'd say I've probably transitioned more to mountain biking.
Ski or snowboard?
Skier.
Desert or mountains?
Desert mountains.
Yeah. Way to thread the needle. All right, Mike Connor, former Deputy Secretary of the Interior under President Obama, thank you very much for your time and for your public service, and we hope you get some much-deserved time off.
Thank you. This was a lot of fun. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right, we always wrap up the show with a look back at this week in Western history, remembering the moments that made the West what it is today. We were just talking to Mike Connor about his work on tribal issues at the Interior Department. What you may not know is that the Bureau of Indian Affairs started out not at Interior, but as part of the Department of War, and it almost ended up back there if it hadn't been for a horrific event that happened this week in 1870. It is now known as the Marias Massacre. This is one of those conflicts that started literally with stolen horses and escalated from there. So the U.S. Army in Montana was trying to track down a band of Piegan Blackfeet led by Mountain Chief. Mountain Chief was harboring a Piegan warrior named Owl Child. He had killed a white rancher named Malcolm Clark. Clark had, according to the Blackfeet, raped Owl Child's wife. That rape was revenge for Owl Child stealing the rancher's horses, and Owl Child had taken those horses, apparently as payment, blaming Clark for the loss of his own horses. So that is the setup. A dispute over horses had grown into a full-on U.S. Army action with the mission of hunting down Mountain Chief and his men. General Philip Sheridan gave the order to, quote, strike them hard, but also to avoid attacking friendly bands of Blackfeet. They were under the command of Major Eugene Baker, and the Army found a camp of 32 lodges along the Marias River in Montana. Major Baker thought they belonged to a hostile Piegan leader, an ally of Mountain Chief. An Army scout recognized, though, that was wrong. It was actually a friendly chief named Heavy Runner. That scout tried to warn Major Baker, but Baker instead placed the scout under arrest and ordered the attack anyway, reportedly saying, quote, that makes no difference, one band or another of them. Baker may have been drunk at the time, by the way. He was a notorious alcoholic. So as Chief Heavy Runner approached the Army with a letter of safe conduct, he was shot dead by another Army scout. And here is where this story takes a truly bizarre turn. That scout who shot Heavy Runner was married to the sister of Mountain Chief, who the Army was supposed to be chasing. That scout knew Mountain Chief was actually 10 miles to the south. He wanted to divert attention from where his brother-in-law's camp was. So when he killed Heavy Runner, the rest of the troops opened fire on that friendly band of Blackfeet. Most of the men from the band were out hunting. The massacre was, in one word, horrific. The U.S. Army killed about 200 Blackfeet, almost entirely women, children, and elderly men. Many of them were already suffering from smallpox. 50 of the victims were under the age of 12. Another 140 Blackfeet survived, some of them by hiding in the Marias River. Remember, this is Montana in January. The river was near freezing. And then Major Baker's men burned what was left of their meager winter food supplies. Mountain Chief, meanwhile, learned of the attack. His band escaped into Canada. Major Baker didn't even file a report for 2 months, and then he lied in it, claiming only 53 women and children died. General Sheridan tried to protect the Army politically. Remember, he was trying to get the Bureau of Indian Affairs back into the War Department. So General Sheridan managed to prevent an official investigation into the massacre, but word got out. Public outrage over the massacre was so severe, even back east, that it pressured President Grant into an official peace policy toward the tribes. President Grant shut down any talk of returning Bureau of Indian Affairs to the War Department and declared that all Indian agents from then on would be civilians rather than soldiers. And that is how a dispute over horses eventually led to the Bureau of Indian Affairs staying inside the Department of the Interior. It happened this week in 1870. All right, that is it for this episode of Go West Young Podcast. Thanks very much to Mike Connor for joining us this week. I also quickly want to mention a report we put out, Busting the Myth of a War on Oil on Our Public Lands. When you look at the numbers, you will see that the industry has more leases on public lands than it knows what to do with. And oil and gas companies have passed up way more leases than they bid on over the past 8 years. You will find that on our website, westernpriorities.org, and on our blog on Medium called Westwise. We always love your feedback on the show. Podcast at westernpriorities.org is where to send your love letters and hate mail. And please, if you enjoy this, leave us a review on iTunes. It is by far the best way for new listeners to find us and what we're doing here. My name is Aaron Weiss. On behalf of Jennifer Rocola and the entire team here at the Center for Western Priorities, thank you very much for listening.